Blog Talk Radio.
I feel I'm bound for glory.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us on the Wise Women Media, the radio show. That was a fabulous song by Tedeschi Trucks Band, Bound for Glory, one of my favorites that they do from, I think, an album or two ago. But it always inspires me. I wanted to let you all know how to get in touch with us and where to find us on the web. Before I introduce our special guest this evening, you can see us at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. And on that website, you can see all of our archives, tonight's complete show description, complete show descriptions for everything that we've broadcasted before, a list of our sponsors, links to our social networks, and don't forget to hit us up on the GoFundMe link. We are independent media, and we don't have any corporate sponsors. So if you want independent media, help us keep it on the air and drop a little money into the GoFundMe account there. I did want to give a shout-out to Here Be Monsters on Blog Talk Radio. They give us this time slot every week, Friday night at 10 p.m., and we do fall under the Common Projects Network. You can find that online also. So many other shows on that network that are independent media and are broadcasting real, true news and information. I also did want to let you all know that I'm having some issues getting the chat room open on Blog Talk Radio. Not sure why that's happening, but if you have questions for the guests and you want to write them out, let me encourage you to go to Facebook. If you're on Facebook, join us at Wise Women Media, the radio show, which is a Facebook group, and you can post your questions there, and I will read them on the air. But the next best thing is to call in, and our call-in number is 213-816-0357. You can call in anytime during the broadcast. We're scheduled for 2 hours. And I want to bring on our guest. Is that guest Robin? Are you on the line with me now?
I am, and good evening. I guess it's a little bit later there for you. I'm just watching sun go down on my mountain here, but I think we're a little bit colder. And thank you, Anita, for inviting me to be on this evening.
Oh, well, thank you for being here. I wanted to make sure that I kind of gave a little information about who you are and what you do. Robin Ledoux is a retired clinical psychologist. She had a former practice in Washington State. You can see more information about her at septembertotems.com. She's been affiliated with the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with the University of Washington Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and the Native American Center of Excellence. She's the award-winning author of Journey Through the Healing Circle, books and video. Dr. Ledoux has lectured worldwide on the effects of prenatal exposure and historical trauma in Native American communities, as well as the consequences of and the treatment for psychological trauma, including traditional Native methods of treatment. She is currently an enrolled member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe of Washington State. This is her first historical fiction writing effort. And, of course, we're talking about The Totems of September, which you can buy right on the website, septembertotems.com. So I'm going to open the floor up to you, Robin, and you can tell us a little bit about how this whole project of the book, Totems of September, was birthed, and what can people expect to feel and learn about from reading your book. So you got it.
Well, that's a huge area to start with, but I first need to give a hello to my friend Diana G. I told her I would do that. She's one of my Facebook friends and another lovely woman who does interviews. But, you know, Anita, to answer your question, the book, September, The Totems of September, primarily takes place from September 10th, 2001 through September 11th, 2006. And it addresses what happened in our country as a result of that day, which for me is as fresh as if it happened yesterday. I was actually at the Minot train station with my Aunt Lucille, who's now passed, and we were getting ready to catch the train from Minot back to Seattle. And the first plane had already hit, and we saw the second plane go into the South Tower. And in my mind forever, the vision I have is that it speeded up right before it hit the tower. I don't know if that's true, but that's my vision. And I had just taken my aunt on her last life journey at the age of 75 to see Crazy Horse on the Mountain. She had wanted to go, and so we had taken the train to Minot. And then I think, as I told Jenny, and I had told her we could fly into Rapid City, and she said she wanted to take the train. And when I told her the train didn't go anywhere near Custer, South Dakota, she said to me, well, you have a driver's license, and that was the end of that. So we drove down to Custer, South Dakota to see Crazy Horse, and it was one of the saddest moments, but also one of the happiest moments of my life to see my aunt be there at that monument and to watch her cry, and realizing that she was, she had made her decision that she I was going to say her goodbyes, and that's talked about in the book about one of our elders who makes his last life journey, a gentleman named Billy Hawk, who I'll talk a little about later. But anyway, we had gone to Devil's Tower, which was what I had wanted to do, and it was just an amazing place. I don't know how many of your listeners have been there and how many have not.
Can you tell
our
listeners a little bit about that location? Because people out here in the eastern parts of the country really don't know about that as a landmark in most cases, unless they've actually been there. But, you know, fill us in and how, what people would see when they go there.
Well, for those of us who are old enough to remember back, I think it was to 1977, I'm going to get the date wrong, it was one of the primary spots in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's in northeastern Wyoming, very near the South Dakota border, and it is this huge monolith that was actually known as Bear Lodge among the Native people there, and there are many Native legends about the tower, but it was the first national monument, and it sits 10 miles outside of a teeny, teeny, tiny town called Hewlett, H-U-L-E-T-T, Wyoming.
Oh,
it's a very
okay.
special place. It's not like any place I've ever been, and I've traveled the world. Very, very spiritual, but some of the Native stories are about this young Native man who was pursuing his sisters, and they climb onto this rock, and the rock lifted into the sky to protect them from their brother who turned into a bear, and what you see is striated sides on the monolith are, in the legend, his scratches from his claws as he attempted to climb up there. But it was one of the very first national monuments well over 100 years ago now. And as I said, it sits 10 miles south of Hewlett, Wyoming. It's very, very spiritual. There is an altar where Native people come and lead their prayer ties and other gifts. You can actually walk around the monolith. I don't know how many feet tall it is. It's very high, but it's very... It's just an amazing place. They allow people to climb it, which I wish they would not do. And the Aboriginal people in Australia actually decided that people could not climb Uluru or Ayers Rock because of its sacredness. And that is what I wish they would do with Devil's Tower, is to not allow it to be climbed. That's my personal opinion, because it is very sacred.
Do you think they're pretty much both Ayers Rock and Devil's Tower are pretty much the same in regards to spiritual significance? Of course, Ayers Rock for the Aboriginal peoples of Australia, and then Devil's Tower for, you know, the First Nation people of North America. Would you consider it the same?
I think that there's a lot of similarities. I've been to Uluru, Ayers Rock, Uluru, as the Aboriginal word is. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's been a while since I was there. And it actually, at dusk, pulses like the heart, and it's wonderful Aboriginal people. I had the wonderful opportunity to meet down there, talk about it being the heart of Australia. And I think Devil's Tower, So obviously Uluru is known among many groups, and Devil's Tower is known among other groups. I think that they have similar spiritual significance that has not been recognized by the non-native
right.
world, but they're very, very sacred places to be honored. I think in that way they're very similar.
Mm-hmm. So this trip, as it progressed, became basically a spiritual journey for both of you then?
Absolutely. It was, it started out as really just the journey of her generation and my generation. And she's passed now, and she was the very traditional one in her generation. She's my father's older sister, my youngest aunt are gone now. And for me, it had spiritual and emotional implications far beyond what I ever imagined was going to happen. So after we went to Devil's Tower, we stayed one night at the Diamond L Ranch in Hewlett, Wyoming, and a great deal of the book Totems takes place at a fictionalized version of the ranch, of the Diamond L Ranch. In the book, it's called the Buffalo Springs Ranch. And I met Gary and Carolyn Luther, who are two of the most amazing people you'd ever want to meet, who ran the ranch. And I was there just for a day in 2001. And then, of course, September 11th hit right after I had left the ranch. And with all the horror and the sadness, and I think, Anita, I talked to you about it, that my aunt and I and the other passengers that were getting on the train in Minot were actually boarded onto the train at 9:30 New York time, 8:30 Minot time, and because we couldn't get any television reception or any phone reception because of the train, we did not know that the towers had fallen until we got to Spokane 24 hours later. So we were in this very odd vacuum at the time all these horrendous events were going on and changing the course of our history. We knew that the first two towers had been hit, but we were getting very spotty information, and people were going off the train, but people were not coming on, and it wasn't until we hit Spokane that we actually saw what had happened. And when I got home, about 18 hours later than I thought I would, that was, I think, the evening of the 12th of September by the time I got home, I was watching the news, and I found out that four people from Raytheon had been, I think, on the first plane, on the American Airlines plane, and were either colleagues or supervisors of my younger brother, Charles, the dude at Raytheon. So as it did in so many ways, it really hit home with my family, what had happened. And the next year, after going through some pretty significant health problems, I actually went back to the ranch. On September 11th, I flew back to Gillette and then up to the ranch on September 11th, 2002, and went out to the tower one evening and with a friend of mine, Debbie Pekin, and another guest, Val Cameo. And it was a full moon night, and I actually laid there on the hot tarmac there of the parking lot and looked up at this beautiful full moon and this huge monolith to the left side of me. And as I said the other day, I just couldn't get over the juxtaposition between this huge, beautiful creation of Creator, this monolith that had been there for 40 million years and was going to stand another 40 million, and these towers that had fallen in an hour. I just couldn't get over the juxtaposition of that, and it was out of that evening that the book actually began to formulate itself and to come into being.
So how was the flow in actually writing it? How long did it take you from start to finish?
Well, I started writing, I went back to the ranch in September 2006, and of course went to Devil's Tower, and I always make at least one or two trips to the tower when I'm back at the Diamond L. And when I got home from that trip, I sat down and just started writing. And I wrote the introductory chapter, and then I wrote the final chapter, the epilogue. And then wrote another chapter called The Red Pony, my own Red Pony, Bailey, my beautiful Poco Bueno quarter horse, and actually my other horse, Bo, actually both came from the Diamond L, and I actually got Bailey in 2002. And his story was the first one I wrote, and I just started writing, and the characters just came and talked to me, and then I read it to a friend of mine, Ken Foster, and he wanted me to write a chapter for him, so I got some names, some characters, and I wrote a chapter for him, and then other people wanted chapters, and so I finished the book and actually read it to another very dear friend of mine, Janelle Oslin, on Anini Beach in Hawaii, January 2009. So the actual writing took about 3 years. A lot of writing, a tremendous amount of research because it is a historical novel. But the interesting thing, Anita, I think I told you, the original working title for the book was Animal Tracks Through Time, and it never fit. And then one day I sat down and I just wrote Totems of September as the name of the book, and I couldn't figure out what the Totems of September were. And then my friend Alan Willoughby said, "Robin, for goodness sake, what's wrong with you?" It was the, you know, the Twin Towers. And I went, "Oh, of course, both were the Totems of September." So sometimes my characters and creator have a sense of humor, and they laugh at me, and I'm always kind of the last one to know the joke. But the writing actually, the first complete draft took 3 years. I put it aside, and then it went back into editing and publication in June of last year, June of 2013. So it sat for 4 years, and then it finally was published. So it was a very long process. But you asked, Anita, about the flow. The best thing I can tell you is that the characters in the book are very real people who actually came and told me their stories. And I think I told you there's two characters in the book, Billy Hawk, who's a Lakota man, and Geronimo Barth, who's Kiowa, who actually met in the boarding schools in Genoa, Nebraska, back in the early 1900s. And my own grandfather and grandfather and great-uncles were forced into the Cushman boarding school here in the state of Washington. So unfortunately, that is a very sad part of my legacy. So I think it was just people wanted their stories told, and I just sat and wrote them down. But doing the historical part of it, it was about 3 years from start to finish.
And people who don't know, these schools, these were like re-education schools, basically to take the Native and Aboriginal peoples of the North American continent and re-educate them into the European customs and traditions, and in so doing would lose their own traditions and customs at the same time. So it was really, I can't think of any other term to call it but re-education, and it's very sad because a whole generations of the Native Americans /First Nations were, they lost their traditions. You know, some maintained them, but then others did not, and they were incorporated into the European ways of doing things. Can you tell us a little bit about what that does to the psyche of someone who is part of the First Nations? How that re-education changes them and their communities?
You know, and I think it's something we really need to talk a little bit about in depth, because the residential schools for the First Nations people, there's tremendously horrendous information that's finally coming out that we've known among ourselves as Native people that's finally coming out, but they were the residential schools that the Aboriginal people were forced into. And the sole purpose, and you can find this in Gidley's book, Under One Sky, was, in quotes, to remove the Indian from the child, which if you think about it, what a terrible thing to even think about. But, you know, I want to talk a little bit about our boarding schools up here in the state of Washington. And I don't know if you are here, because we just had a very huge case come out of this. I think it was 2010, 2011, very recently, there was a lawsuit against the Jesuits who ran the boarding schools here in the state of Washington and nearby, and the Jesuits paid $166 million to 400-some plaintiffs for the abuse that people my age, I'm 59, experienced in the boarding schools. They're not closed. This has been going on for well over 100 years. They were set up very deliberately by the U.S. government and the churches, often run by the churches, Jesuits, to specifically take away our language, our land, our culture. And what that does is it leaves you with nothing. If you can imagine, and even people listening in, that tomorrow, you're 6 years old, and tomorrow a man you've never met is going to come and going to take you from your family and take you miles and miles and miles away. And if you get to, you might see them once a year. And if other cases, you may never see them again, or you might not see them until they're 18. And if you think about that, what it's like to be beaten for speaking a language that you're born into and for having spiritual beliefs. And I want to just add something right here. I know that many listeners may not know, it was illegal for me as a Native person to practice my Native traditions and religious beliefs until 1978, when the Indian Child, the Indian Religious Freedom Act. It was open 1978 with the Indian Child Welfare Act that the wholesale removal of Native children from their families was slowed. It has not been stopped, and I think the Baby Veronica case out of Oklahoma is a terrible example of what still goes on with Native children. But to answer your question, I can look at my own family with my father telling us very quietly that we were Native, and it being a very shameful thing that he didn't talk about, although he certainly educated his children, particularly me, in very, very traditional ways. I know a tiny bit of my language, but all this, our culture's gone, and it's caused tremendous problems among my family, among people. It's, you know, are you more Indian than I am? Are your traditions? And really what it comes down to is, if you can imagine, Anita, tomorrow you get up and you're 6 years old and you never see your parents again, and you're beaten if you speak English, and you're beaten if you read the Bible, and your hair is cut without your permission, and you are dressed in uniforms. And I think I sent you some pictures of my family. If not, I can do that. But everything you've ever known is gone, and you are told that you are nothing, literally nothing, and you're never going to be white, and you're never going to be red, and you're going to nothing, just basically nothing. In my own life, my mother was Greek. My father was, as I spoke, Métis and French Canadian and Native, and I'm enrolled at Tlaloc, and I'm actually of the Thai Nipun Band, which is Upper Tlaloc, and we're a different linguistic group. But I think I was telling you that, you know, I know very few words in my language, and my culture is gone. And when you look at that and you try and regain your culture, it's such abuse at such a deep level. But as a child at school, my brothers and sisters and I were called dirty Indians, which was very painful. And, you know, it made no sense to me as a child, because every night my mother would make me take a bath. And so I didn't know what that meant, that I was a dirty Indian, because obviously I was clean. And so you can begin to see right then the self-loathing and the colonization begins to take place. And then I had people who said to me, well, Robin, and I hear this all the time, well, you don't look like an Indian. It's like, okay, well, what does an Indian look like? You know, and so you get that.
Right.
Honestly, Anita, if I had a penny for every time I've heard that, I would be very, 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 very wealthy. But it's almost absurd. And there was a little thing that was floating around among the Native websites on Facebook, Native posts on Facebook that said 10 questions to ask your white friends. What part white are you? You don't look white. I'm not a racist. I have white friends. And can I touch your facial hair? And can I take your picture? And people kind of take a step back at that, but I've had every single one of those comments made to me. What part Indian are you? You don't look like an Indian. One of the favorite things I get now, living where I do in very rural, is, well, you got your enrollment card. Does that mean you can hunt out of season? And if you do, can I go with you? It's like, what? So it's people respond to very strange. I was trying to say, my family ranges the gamut from black eyes and black hairs to myself, which is brown hair and green eyes, to my sister, older sister, who had black hair and blue eyes. And we're all the same quantum, which is another term I hate. But it gets into this, you know, are you really Indian? Are you not Indian? And the other thing, Anita, I don't know how old you are, but I grew up in the time of John Wayne, and the only good Indian was a dead Indian, and cowboys and Indians. And if you think about the images that we were shown, which is we were these horrible people who were going to kill the settlers, and we had to be slaughtered, and one of the issues that I'm still really angry about is the whole term Redskins, and Dan Snyder's absolute arrogance in acknowledging that that is an incredibly painful racial slur. It's horrible. We don't call people, the teams, we don't have any yellow skin teams or black skin teams or cracker skin teams or any names like that, or the N-word teams. We would never allow those terms, but somehow Redskins is supposed to honor me. And I can tell you, as a Native person, I feel no honor in being referred to as subhuman who had a bounty placed on my head and was called a Redskin as proof that I was dead, as a dead Native person. I just don't find that honorable, and I think it's really arrogance and greed mm-hmm. that keeps Dan Snyder in that. And I'm very disappointed that you know, he went out and spoke to 26 people, nations, and threw out some money, and then the whole issue is decided because 26 nations, whatever, I don't even know. But the truth of the matter is there's nothing honorable in that term, but that's what I grew up with, and that's what, if you go back generations, we are the group that really are still targeted. I mean, I look at some of the costumes like Victoria's Secret model,
right.
Heidi Klum and Cher, and it's like, that's not who we are. But you would never see people dressed up as other ethnic groups like that, ever. It would be so, and if there were, people would be incredibly offended. But because it's Native, what I get told all the time is like, well, we're honoring you. It's like, no, I'm sorry. I don't see how you putting paper feathers in your hair and wearing a fringe bikini honors me in any way, shape, or form. I'm sorry, I don't feel honored. And part of what I speak about in the book is how we as Native people have held on to our traditions and have survived through our traditions in spite of the mockery that's continually made of our traditions. And that's a big part of the book. And it is healing and recovering from trauma through the real use of our traditions, not through mockeries made of them.
Right, right. You know, you've seen a lot of this re-education. For instance, in the black communities as well, and you'll see a lot of the references, well, you're not black enough, or you're not, you know. Like, for instance, a lot of people gave, you know, Bill Cosby a lot of flack for portraying a black man that so many black men did not live that experience, you know, being an OBGYN doctor and having a lawyer for a wife and living a very upscale life that just isn't a real true portrayal of the black experience if you're actually talking to most black people. And people found that kind of interesting and have given him a hard time ever since. So when we had the pre-interview and we talked a little bit about the First Nation experience from the respective being in Quebec. And as I can venture to say, after all of my genealogical research on my family, when the French came over to New France, to Quebec, the only Catholics, I mean, they were encouraged to marry Catholics, of course, but the only Catholic women, unless they were shipped over from France and other places, were the Native women, you know, the First Nation women that had already been baptized into the Catholic Church. So there was a lot of intermarriage going on, and a lot of the Quebec people can state, and probably in my family as well, that they are Métis, which means mixed blood, which means really that your heritage is so mixed you can't even go back and figure out what tribe you're from or what linguistic place you came from or anything like that. And in the Catholic Church, births and deaths and marriages were recorded, and that was really all they had to record any of these life events. And many times it was never stated, of course, that the wife was from the tribe, from the First Nations. She was, her baptismal name or her confirmation name was what was noted in the church register. So,
well,
all
you know,
of this,
that, and if you,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Nina, sorry. I was just going to say, if you look at my own family.
Yeah, all of it worked together to kind of just disintegrate the First Nation presence in that area. You know, it's like the French came in, they took over, and that's it. And my mother was very olive-skinned, had black eyes. You couldn't even see her pupils, very dark hair. And when I look at old pictures from her great-grandparents, very, very dark-complected people. So I would venture to say they were probably intermarried, but I can't even go back and prove it because there's no way to prove it. So,
yeah, as we were talking in my own family history on the Ledoux side, Louis Ledoux, who was worked for Hudson Gibet Company, was Catholic, and from what we know, he was Métis. So I have Métis blood, and the Métis blood is well recognized as contributing to the Kalispah, the tribe that I'm enrolled with. And he, Louis, married a woman whose name was Potomkin in Tidefum language, and she was christened Marguerite Cowlitz, and she was not Cowlitz, but that was her christened name. And so we have Louis Ledoux marrying a Cowlitz woman, and because she was of the Cowlitz people, actually lived on the Cowlitz River, although she was not Cowlitz. And that's where my lineage starts that we can trace back, although actually Marguerite was actually the daughter of Skaniwa, who was a principal chief of the Tidenapum people. And so I'm very fortunate that I, on my father's side, can go back seven generations and know that history as I do on my mom's Greek side. But I think, you know, Anita, part of what you talked about with the boarding schools, and I want to go back to that a little bit, is the legacy of our incredible traditions and our language and our children were stripped from us, and it was a very, very, very deliberate practice. There was nothing that wasn't deliberate about it. It was intended to, in a term I absolutely hate and despise, assimilate. And I think that one of the things that I hear less of these days, although it still certainly comes up, and it came up among some of my own tribal family members this last week, about, you know, who's Cowlitz enough or who's not Cowlitz enough. And it's like, I just say to people, I'm not even going to address things on that level, because that was such a divide and conquer tactic used by the Europeans, which is the whole quantum system where, you know, you are assigned a blood quantum, like, well, you're this much or that much or this much, and it's ridiculous to me, you know, because as I say to people, a lot of times, you know, it's like, you know, how do you define who's native? And Wilma Mankiller, who was the principal chief of the Cherokee, said, you know, if you're, you know, an Indian is an Indian. It's not about blood. It's about who you are. And I think that in terms of the boarding school, the atrocities that were done are just so horrendous. And it wasn't just to wipe out the spirit and the nativeness of Native children. Those children were murdered. They were sexually abused. They were tortured.
Right.
And people don't want to talk about that. And when I was a junior in high school, my history book, American history book, had a great big huge section on Manifest Destiny and what a wonderful thing Manifest Destiny was. And I would go home at night and I would say to, but Daddy, that's not true. Why do we, you know, I don't understand. And he would say, you have to get an A in that class. It's like, but Daddy, none of that's true. And he'd say to me, but you have to get an A in that class. And so I said, but Daddy, it's not the truth. And so very early on in my life was this huge push-pull between who we were at home and could talk about and what we could not talk about out in the world. And it's very crazy-making. If you talk to sex abuse survivors, it's the same thing. You know, we're not allowed to be who we really are. And in any environment where you have that, it creates tremendous trauma. And I can remember when I was 10, not quite 10, I was not quite 10, my dad coming home from Washington and crying and telling us about the Nisqually and the Muckleshoot and the Puyallups who were shot and murdered out on Commencement Bay by federal agents for fishing, for exercising their treaty rights out on Commencement Bay, and were actually murdered because of their being Native, and him coming home because my dad fished during the summer to support his very large family. Both my parents were school teachers, which didn't have a big income for supporting six kids. And I can remember my dad coming home and telling me this story and me saying, but Daddy, why were they killed? And him saying, because they were Indian, because they were like us. And then having to go to school and hear how great the U.S. was, and it created, as you can imagine, tremendous conflict. And I still, and I don't think that I've even fully reconciled that conflict. It still catches up with me at times in the most unexpected ways. So imagine being, you know, a five-year-old child and having to sort all that out, that you know, you can talk about this part of your life here, you can't talk about it there. When you go to school, you're a dirty Indian. At the store down where my family shopped, when I went with my Native family, we were relegated to very small, to the colored portion, as they called it, part of the store. When I went with my white mother, we could shop anywhere we wanted in the store. And try and imagine being a child and figuring out what that means. I think it was devastating. And then if you multiply that by what the boarding schools did, you know, a million times over for 12 years, imagine the horror that that would be. And I need to just let people know the boarding schools are not closed. They are still open. And I have some real issues with that, about why they're still open. And I think if people get a chance, they should read the lawsuit that was settled by the Jesuits. And it actually came out of Yakima, out of the Tamaki Law Firm here in Yakima, which is about 60 miles from where I live. But those things are still going on, Anita, in the most horrific ways, every single day. I'm always amazed at the racism I have to deal with every single day, just by going into town, the racism I deal with. It's just, and you think it almost gets you used to it.
Hey, tell us about the schools that are open now. How can they, can you tell us whether the school's treatment of the First Nation people has improved, or can we assume that the same kinds of things are going on?
Well, do you want to hear the public story or what I've seen myself?
I'd like to hear both.
Okay, well, I used to, it's a touchy issue, so I'm going to say it as diplomatically as I can. I used to work in the field of fetal alcohol syndrome when I was at the University of Washington. And on one of the reservations that I'm familiar with, I won't name, one of the boarding schools was still very much open. And there were still all kinds of concerns about children being sexually abused. But there was a little bit difference that was going on, and I don't know of any research that's been done on this about the kids that now are in the boarding schools. I don't know in the generations that's going on right now. I can certainly speak for my generation and the generations before and the generation immediately after me, but there was still all sorts of accusations about the kids being abused. Sexual abuse between the kids, sexual abuse to the children, physical abuse. It would be really hard to get a lot of information now. I wish I could say that the culture within the school has changed. I don't know if it has because it's a boarding school, but I think that the wholesale removal of Native children from homes to be put into the boarding school certainly has been diminished as a result of the 1978 Act. However, we still have issues with ICWA, Indian Child Welfare Act, being violated up one side and down the other with illegal removals of children from their tribes. I think Veronica Brown and Dustin Brown is an incredibly sad example of that, what happened with that child being inherited with her father and then being removed and given back to the white adopted parents. But in terms of the boarding schools, I evaluated children in those schools, and many of the children have fetal alcohol syndrome. There are still all kinds of horrendous abuse issues that come up. I think the attitude about placing the children in school is changing dramatically. I truly think it is. But the issue of Native families and Native parents still not being competent enough to raise their children comes up all the time, and you can see it just everywhere you look.
It's kind of like, you know, there's so many parallels to the black community, I can't believe it. It's almost like they set it up so the mother, the young mother that can't get education, there's no social safety net for her to make it. They set it up for her to fail. And then DCF steps in and takes the kids, and the mother's left with having to prove herself that she's a good person and can get a good job and make enough money, then she can get her children back. And, you know, I've never been for some of the things that I've seen DCF do to families. It's really just tears families apart. And a lot of times the kids are going into even worse and even more dangerous scenarios with foster families. So I guess the parallels are so similar, except the black children are not being put in what I would call a school with a specific curriculum. They're being fostered out in most cases. Now, I've talked a little bit about the similarities. Tell me about the differences, how the black children would be, from what you've seen, how are black children treated differently from First Nation Native American peoples?
Oh, that is a really touchy question, Anita. I can't purport, of course, to speak for the black community or the African American community because, you know, that's not my culture. However, having worked with the social welfare and DSHS system in the state of Washington for, 30 years, I think in the state of Washington, and that's the area that I'm most familiar with, I think some of the similarities are some of the inherent beliefs that minority parents can't raise their children and don't know how to do it, right?
Exactly.
That's rampant.
Yeah.
That is rampant.
Right.
I think that there's been a change since 1978, since the Indian Child Welfare Act, where many of the tribes now, and I don't really want to get into how people do or do not feel about casino monies, but I've seen them do, the monies have done some pretty wonderful things in some of the communities. I don't agree with all of it, but they've done some pretty wonderful things. And one of the things that they've funded in many Native communities here in the state of Washington are tribal child welfare programs now, where it's the tribes that retain the jurisdiction of their children and make the decisions. And I think that's a huge shift. I think that from my work in communities, I think that one of the things that still troubles me, because I think people just don't really have any sense of what they're doing, is cross-race, cross-ethnic adoption, where people somehow think that you can love a child into being exactly like you, or love a child into being normal, or love a child into whatever it's imagined. And you touched on something, Anita, that I want to back up to, which is this absolute, complete fantasy we have that foster families and adoptive families are perfect. It's this wholeness we've fostered. And we've seen it over and over again with these families who adopt all these children, and they're motivated by whatever. And then we had a horrendous case, just a terrible, terrible, terrible case here in the state of Washington this last year, where this family who, this is not meant to offend anybody, but I will go by their descriptions, said that they were very good Christians who were motivated by God to adopt all these children, and they ended up killing one of their foster daughters from, an adopted daughter, I believe she was from Ethiopia, killed her, starved her to death, and beat her brother terribly bad. But yeah, they got, I think, 15 years, 7 years, something like that, I don't remember. But it was horrendous, absolutely horrendous. And, they literally starved this child to death. She was in her early teens. And in terms of, I don't mean to step on people's toes, but this is my reality, is what I've seen in situations where I think people necessarily intend to have it, but there's still what I call the missionary attitude towards minority children from the white culture. And I want to just stop there and say, when I talk about white, I'm not talking necessarily about color, but I'm talking about attitude, white privilege. And boy, do I run into that a lot. And you can have white privilege from a lot of different directions, but it's basically the whole idea behind slavery that African Americans were not human, and certainly we as Native people are still not even seen as human. And I want to talk about an example of racism that I recently ran into, I think I talked to you about. But I think what's different in the black community is just by virtue of the size of the African-American population in the United States, it's far larger than what we as Native people are. We're about 1% or less of the population. So I think that we're tiny, tiny.
Right.
And you know, I think I cannot believe for one second that the African-American community would allow Dan Snyder to have a football team called the Anskins. I just don't believe for one second that anybody in this country would sit down and say, that's okay, but we can have the Redskins, and somehow that's okay. It's not okay. But I think that what's different is the black community has had a far greater voice than we as Native people. And I think we're just finally really saying that we have to have a voice, and there's lots of reasons that are coming because of that. But the tribes now are beginning to really say, no, our children are our future, and really pushing to not have illegal adoptions, to not have full-scale removal. But I had a situation a few years back, you know, when I was still working, with a young Native mom who was just very ill-equipped to have children, and there were family members who were more than willing to step in, who were perfectly appropriate, very appropriate guardians and parents, just absolutely perfectly appropriate, under the Indian Child Welfare Act, and the little girl had been with her foster family, I think, for about 6 months. And the guardian lighter in that case greatly overstepped her bounds. They're supposed to be a neutral thing, and she was coaching the foster mom who showed up at my office for the evaluation when she wasn't supposed to be there, just greatly overstepped her bounds. And basically my judgment was that this child needed to go with her family. And the foster mother was approached by the guardian ad litem, came and said, well, my husband's a quarter Native. And I said, well, what band? Well, she didn't know what band. I said, well, you've been married to him for 27 years. How can you not know what band he's from? You know, you can't just come in and say he's quarter Native, and what does that mean? But I think that with the black community, there's just been far stronger voices, a greater presence, more people in Congress, there's just a larger population. Well, with Native people, people still don't even know where it exists. If you could, I'd like to digress and talk about what happened to me with United Airlines. Did we talk about that in our pre-interview?
We talked about that in the pre-interview, and I think that would be interesting for the listeners to hear it. So, tell us the story.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about, in the book, I do talk about racism and how Native people are viewed and how our culture has been lost over the generations, which is a little bit we're talking about. But people say to me, well, Robin, you have a PhD, you're almost 60 years old, you're well educated, you've been successful in your life, certainly you don't have to deal with racism. It's like, yes, I do, and I'm absolutely going to name the airline. I have no problems doing that, and I'm more than happy to talk about their response. But I was flying on United Airlines from Seattle to Denver on August 23rd of last year. I was on my way to Gillette and then on up to the Diamondale Ranch in Hewlett. And I have my tribal identification card. It has my name, my birth date, my address, my government number. Yes, I have a government number. I belong to the government, so I have my government number on my tribal ID card. And a tribal ID card is a valid ID for travel by the TSA and by the airline, by United Airlines. And when I went to check in at the desk, I had to get a refund on part of my ticket, and the woman who I first talked to couldn't do it. She had a gentleman come over, and he processed it and then asked for my ID to give me my boarding pass, and I gave him my tribal ID, and he pushed it back across the counter and told me it wasn't a valid ID, that I couldn't have my boarding passes until I had a valid ID. He gave him a valid ID. And I said, no, actually, it was a valid ID, and I showed him the name, my name, my picture, my birth date, my address, and he pushed it back to me, and he said, this is not a valid ID. And I pushed it back, and I said, yes, it is a valid ID. And he said, I'm not going to give you your boarding passes until you give me a valid ID. And I said, this is a valid ID. And he said, well, you're not going to get your boarding passes until you give me your driver's license. And he wouldn't. And I pulled my driver's license out, and what would I have done if I hadn't had a driver's license? I wonder then. And as I gave him my driver's license, I pointed out my name, my address, my birth date, my picture, and I said to him, you know, you've just perpetrated racism against me. And he looked at me and kind of pulled back, and he said he knew all about racism because he had grown up white in South Africa. And I said, then certainly you understand you've just perpetrated racism on me. And I said, can I have my boarding passes now? And he said, yes, you can have them now, and handed me back my IDs. And I was very upset and very angry. There was an African-American woman behind me and a Latino man. He checked them through with no problems. I made a complaint to United Airlines, and what I got back was, oh, well, you know, we're sorry you're upset. You know, we fly millions of people of divergent cultures, and we're sure that he didn't mean anything about it. And the first woman kept saying she, and I kept saying, no, the agent was a he. And we're sure that they didn't mean to offend you. It's like, well, you weren't there during the conversation. You didn't see what happened. And basically, I was told that United Airlines does not compensate for discrimination or bad practices on the part of their agents, which I thought was quite interesting. And I basically was told, well, it's a training problem, and we're sure the agent didn't mean any problems. And the topper was, and we hope you fly United Airlines again. It's like, probably not going to happen. But it was really incredibly offensive. I hadn't had that kind of blatant in my face in a long time. And I think people really need to understand that we as Native people, whether we're full blood or mixed blood, are the recipients of that in a million ways every single day. And I want to draw that back to the book, Anita, because you asked me and other people say, well, Robin, how do you get through all this? And this is my traditions, you know, my absolute belief in my traditions, the things I was taught by my father, by my teachers, by my elder Jerry Bouchard, who's still with us, and Gracie Wannasey and her husband Dale Dunkel, and my aunties and other teachers. And it's the rootedness of that culture, Anita, that I think helps people get through. As I sit here and I tell you that story about the United agent, I can find myself really angry all over again. I have 830,000 air miles on United Airlines. It'll be no more, I can guarantee that. But to be treated with such disrespect was just, you know, it's shocking. You know, it's like, what are you talking about? And, you know, and of course it wasn't. For any Native people listening out there, yes, your tribal ID card is valid. And if they have for you about it, get on the TSA website and you can print it out. I carry it with me now. I carry the list of TSA-approved IDs. Mine's laminated, and if there's a hassle, I hand them the list. You know, and that's what I'm doing now. But it's offensive to me that one more time, because of my Native blood, I'm being told I can't even get on an airplane that I've for an airline that I've flown 830,000 miles on. And I think, Anita, part of what happens is, people push to the side. Like, and I've heard, I can't tell you how many times, well, he didn't mean anything. Well, maybe he just didn't know. It's like, no, this was a senior agent for United Airlines, and it was blatant discrimination. And so when I look at that, you know, there's a part of me that goes back to being that five-year-old child. I'm sorry, my cat's decided he's going to join us here. That five-year-old child who sits in the class and says, well, Robin, you're a dirty Indian. You have to sit back there, and wondering, what did I do wrong? And so when you look at that over my lifespan, which is now very close to 60, there's a part of me that really has to fight about not internalizing that.
That is a really tough, that's a tough thing there. And it can't really be compared a lot of times to the black experience, or even being just a female, you know. And knowing that you're experiencing blatant, you know, sexism, like in the workplace or something like that, that's tough. That's really tough. So how do we get up and get beyond that?
Well, I think I can only speak of the people I've worked with and for myself. And one of the things that I have and again, it came up among some of my tribal people this week. It's like, you know, it'll be a very cold day in a Christian hell before I ever say that this person is more callous than me or less callous than me or more thai bapam or less thai bapam or more traditional or less traditional, because I think it's important for people to understand that in the black communities, the African-American communities, because there was still a greater number of people, although many of the cultures and traditions have been lost, absolutely, there was still a bigger population base on which to pull strength from. And I really can't emphasize that enough. It's very, you know, I have so many wonderful African American friends that I'm very close to, and I want to just mention one right now, Dr. J.T. King, who I'm going to have the great pleasure of seeing in this coming week in New Jersey at a conference there from the Multicultural Family Institute. He and I have had conversations very deep into the night about how racism has affected him as an African American man and how racism affects me as a Native woman who many people look and say, oh, you're white based on color, and other people see very clear that I'm Native. And we talked about where our experiences converge, which is for him being an African American man. He talks about people always seeing him as the rapist, you know, and the man who you have to, you know, lock your doors next to and, you know, when you're around and things like that. And that kind of terrible stereotyping, you know, and I don't know if any of you followed the Seahawks. I didn't have any choice to because I live in Seahawks territory and it was all in the news. But Richard Sherman, who's an extremely bright African-American man, said some comments that I thought were kind of stupid, but nothing compared to what a lot of players do. And he was called a thug. And I look at these other non-African-American players making the same comments without that really negative title put on him. And we talked about how language is very racist. And I think in any minority community, if you look at the words that are used to describe people, our experiences are the same. I think where Jay's and my experience diverge is when he was in graduate school, there were other African-American students in his graduate programs, that there was mentors as a psychologist where he came out. And that's one of the things I get a little upset when they put down Bill Cosby, because we do have very brilliant and very educated African-American physicians who are well-known, and we also have those people in our Native communities, but we don't get publicity. So I think one of the big differences, Anita, is that I think the African-American group has done an incredible job of advocating for themselves in ways that we as Native people have not learned to do yet. And I think that's coming. Idle No More, I think, is a huge step towards that. But I want to talk about one other difference that I've seen in terms of the issue of passing.
Right.
It's not something that I or any of my Native family members or tribal members have ever talked about. It would never occur to us to try and pass or not pass. And I'm speaking from my very personal experience. But at the same moment,
some of our listeners may not understand what that term means. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and I'm going to do that in this example I'm giving. I was presenting at this multicultural conference. It's probably 10 years ago now, and I was talking about, you know, the what my my very beloved Auntie Lucille used to call our blood's getting diluted, she used to say. Our blood's getting diluted. And, you know, how the one drop, I don't know if people know the one drop, if you're one drop African-American, you're African-American, versus if you're a quarter Native American, you're white. It's very confusing. But
right.
Passing is looking, and I put that in quotes, white enough that you can be seen as white in the community and white by other people, and thus be the recipient of white privilege that other people who are more visibly, and again, in quotes, Native or African-American, it's a privilege they would not have based on appearance. So the whole notion of passing is that you, in quotes, can pass for white, which, of course, the majority culture assumes is that you would want to do. So at this conference I was speaking at, I was talking about my own family history, our tribal history, the legal history and the political history of Native people in this country. And one of the women who was African-American on the panel said, you know, Robin, I really applaud you for standing up and claiming your nativeness when you could so easily pass, meaning I looked white, stereotypically
right.
white because I have green eyes and brown hair. And I was very, very taken aback, and I had never, ever had anybody say anything like that to me. And I looked at her and I said, but what makes you think I would want to? You know, I don't really feel the need to not claim my Native heritage. And that was a very interesting experience. And I talked a lot about that with Jay, and having him help me understand that because of the very Native connotations of being African-American and still in portions of our country and historically, that was something that among the history that people, African-American people, would pass, again, to gain white privilege. or attempts at white privilege.
Right.
Native people, I don't think that's something that we've ever even had the opportunity to even think about, because I think we've been in, and still are, in such survivor mode.
In the black community, of course, I hate to keep drawing parallels, but, you know, the black community, people in the black community, it could pass as it did. And really, even in, when you go back into the history with Thomas Jefferson's alleged children with Sally Hemings, several
mm-hmm.
of his children ended up in D.C., Washington, D.C. society.
Mm-hmm.
According to the story, they were able to pass as white, moved into Washington, and coming from the plantation, people didn't know their history.
Well,
it worked
for
them.
Can I just talk a little bit about historically in terms of how, I'm sorry, my cat is very chatty tonight, in terms of historical aspects and non-historical that, I want to talk a little bit about the quantum system, because that's where this whole thing is, what part Indian are you, meaning how much Indian blood you have in you, comes from.
I don't understand that, and I don't understand what makes somebody a legitimate Native American or Métis. I don't know how that's broken down. Can you explain how somebody would be able to be a card-carrying member of a tribe?
Well,
I don't understand that. That's beyond me.
Well, I can tell you how I became a card-carrying member of my tribe. Way, way back in the late 1800s, when the reservation systems were drawn up and the government decided that they were going to decide, big surprise there, who was and who was not an Indian, Native Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a term that I absolutely detest. It's another one of my issues with Cher. I have a lot of issues with Cher, but that's another one. Her song, Half-Breed, which is a term I just despise. But some tribes, if your grandmother was a full-blood Native and your father was half, and then you would be a quarter. So your quantum would be a quarter, which means one-fourth of your blood is Native, which I don't know how they do that cell by cell. I've never figured out how each of my cells know which part of them is white and which part of them is not. But so that's what basically the quantum system is, that again, you were full blood, your child was half, and your grandchild was quarter, and then down an eighth. And the tribes now say, my tribe enrolls on descendancy, and I'll explain that in a second. But a lot of membership was that you had to be a quarter, whatever the tribe was, to enroll in the tribe, to be recognized as a member of that tribe. So you had quantum standards, which means if you were less than a quarter of such a tribe, you could not enroll.
Right.
And my tribe does not allow dual enrollment, although many of the people in my tribe have more than one tribal background. You can only enroll, from my tribe, as the Cowlitz people, you can only enroll in one tribe. And I want to give you a little bit of historical trivia here. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, which set up all the quantum systems, was originally the Bureau of War, which people...
Ooh, that's spooky.
It tells a lot about...
That's just really
spooky,
isn't it? It's, that they would do that? That they would use that same organization?
Well, I think it says a lot about how we're viewed in this country.
Yeah.
So anyway...
Yeah.
Standards were set up by the Bureau of Wars, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, on a quantum system, which meant that as people married out of the tribe and into non-Native families, there became less and less of us. So it was basically a way of, as my auntie in her very inimitable way said, well, they tried to breed us out of existence. You know. And so that was the whole point of quantum, that as people married outside the tribe and their children had, in quotes, less and less Indian blood, again, I don't know how you measure that, then the tribe would just basically disappear.
And that's basically what they've been doing for the past how many generations now? We can look at history and how that's happened.
At this point in time, you've got to look hundreds of years now that this has been going on. My tribe enrolls on descendancy, which means if you are descended from a Cowlitz person, you're Cowlitz. And I'm far more comfortable with that. I want to just take you back about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years now, to the terrible debate between Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown. Do you remember how he opened that debate with her by pointing at her
yes.
and saying, "Does she look like an Indian?" Do you remember his statement? Look at her. Does she look like an Indian? And
I remember it really,
and to me that is the epitome of white male privilege towards minority women. And if she, I don't know her ethnic background. I am not going to say whether she has native blood or not. I don't know, you know. But to make that statement, he could have been making that to me based on my coloring. Look at her. Does she look like an Indian? And that is such an inherently incredibly white male racist comment to make. It was just shocking. And I don't think it did him any favors either. I think that was kind of where karma came around. But I think with the African-American community, they don't have to have cards that say that they're African-American. I carry a tribal enrollment card that says I officially am a card-carrying member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe of Washington. And it has my picture, has my government number. On the back, it's signed by our tribal chair, Bill I.L., and that says, I am officially, based on whatever criteria now set by my tribe, I am recognized as a member of that tribe, and that's how I got my card, with being able to trace my lineage back and through my father's enrollment, my grandfather's enrollment, my great-grandfather's enrollment, and going back, well, we can go back, as I said, seven generations. And that's how I got my card, by being recognized as being eligible for membership and as a member of the Cowlitz tribe, based on my blood quantum and history.
Wow. That's so that kind of breaks it down on how it's considered, and that's called quantum. Is that
quantum.
The term?
Quantum.
Wow.
Yes. Amount. Quantum. Yeah. It's pretty horrible. It's
yeah.
pretty horrible. You know, and I don't know any other group, Anita, any other ethnic group in this country that has to carry a card with their picture on it that says what group they belong to.
No, I haven't heard that. That's almost like, you know, Hitler, you know, show us your papers kind of thing. It's pretty much the same. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me? I just had to switch phones. I'm sorry. I had to walk in the other room and pick up the phone because I was hearing that this one was going to, the battery's gone dead. I've had some real issues with phones lately, including my cell phone. So can you hear me okay now?
I can.
Good, good. I'm glad. I'm going to put on speakers so I can hear you better. Tell us, you know, as I've read through the description of the book, have you ever thought about doing a screenplay of this?
You know, Ned, I have been asked that so many times. It's just a matter of sitting down and actually looking at what that would entail. And I do want to talk a little bit about the book, if we can transition over to that for just a moment and maybe tie
sure.
some of our conversation together. There are three families in the book. One is, as I said, Lakota, that's the Hawk family. And the other one is Kiowa, which is the Barnes family, and then the LaFleur family, which is from the Northwest. And the histories of these families are very typical of many of the Native families, and the Native tribes in our country. And I want to talk a little bit about culture. The book, as I said, starts on September 10th, 2001, with the main character in the book, a woman named Lola LaFleur, and she has a stripper's name, but she's about the most down the middle of the road, self-contained person you'd ever want to meet, anything but a stripper. But she comes from this family of women who basically just women. They don't have male children, and nobody stays married too long. But I think part of what I want to talk about the book is that it's not just about Native families. There's stories in there of Afghani vets and post-traumatic stress syndrome and what happens to our veterans when they come back. And I want to just do a quick comment here that I was watching the news tonight before we came on, and about the very sad shooting in Fort Hood that we have. And
right.
I, as I was listening to this, I was thinking, I was wondering if this was going to be another suicide by cop in that regards, in listening to this man's story. But we know, Anita, that 22 veterans a day commit suicide. And
yeah, why
news,
is nobody bringing that up? That's a good, very good point.
We absolutely have to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, getting into the politics of this, you know, if we've got the money, you know, trillions of dollars to create all these war theaters and send all these young people to, you know, young people and middle-aged people now to fight in these different conflicts all over the world, then certainly you would think that we would have the money to be able to bring them home and give them A1 care. And that includes mental health and anything else they need. You know, back in the day in Vietnam, we used to call that kind of condition, the PTSD condition, we used to call that shell-shocked. So when guys came back from Vietnam, we were saying, oh, yeah, they do crazy stuff. They're just shell-shocked. And we blew it off like it wasn't anything. So, of course, later that condition evolved into post-traumatic stress syndrome, which is PTSD. And I think many, many more people coming back suffer from that than anyone would care to admit. Do you think I'm right about that?
Well, I mean, I think your last statement is the most important one, care to admit. And I think I absolutely was against the Iraqi invasion. And to this day, I will not call it a war because it was not a war. This country invaded a country that posed no threat whatsoever to our safety in any way, shape, or form. None. It was an invasion. We also invaded Afghanistan. And I think that if you... Well, my husband is a disabled Vietnam vet. He was drafted and was in Vietnam in 1969 and was shot up pretty bad. And I've watched him suffer with his PTSD and all that for the last 32 years now. But I think you don't sell a war by saying, and you're going to come back without your limbs, and you're going to come back without your memory, and you're going to come back with traumatic head injury, and you're going to come back with nightmares and night terrors, and you're going to have a far greater risk of substance abuse, and your family's not going to recognize you, and you're going to be jumpy and edgy for the rest of your life, and you're going to have problems with employment, and you're going to have problems maintaining your, not losing your temper, and you're going to have problems not screaming at people, and you're not going to, you know, you're going to be suicidal. I don't think if people told them, what we hear about is, oh, we're going to go off and fight, you know, Saddam Hussein. In fact, we don't need to fight Saddam Hussein. He was no threat. But you don't make money and convince people to go to war if you tell them what the truth of war is. You know, people aren't going to sign up and say, yeah, you're going to lose both your legs. You're going to have an incredibly bad traumatic brain injury, which is going to make it extremely difficult for you to function in a technical world. You're going to have nightmares that you won't even believe. You know, you're going to crawl under the table if you hear a door slam. For years, I have a very dear friend whose husband is an Iraqi vet, and she and I joke sometimes that we stand in the garage and scream up to our husbands where we are, that we're coming into the house when we come in. And as they've gotten deafer and deafer, the screams get louder so that they're not surprised when you come into the house. And they don't
right.
say, and your wife's going to have to stand in the garage and scream to let you know that she's there and never reach over you at night and never sneak up behind you or startle you or any of those things. Because if we told the truth about it, Anita, first off, who's going to go and want to participate in that? And by the way, when you get to Iraq, you're going to find out that there are really no world weapons of mass destruction. It was all a lie. And you're going to lose all these things on the basis of a lie. I mean, how do you sell a war on that basis? You don't. You have buildings come down, and you have terrorists on every corner, and you scare the crap out of people, and you enact the Patriot Act, and then you bang the drums of war. And it's nothing new. This has been going on as long as human beings have been around. And I think what happened is, I really want to stop a second here, and I want to thank the Iraqi and Afghani veterans and the Vietnam veterans. And in my culture, while we may not ever necessarily agree with the war. We never, ever, ever ignore or abuse our veterans. And for me, seeing how our veterans get treated is just appalling, because I come from a culture where no matter what, you support your warriors. You always acknowledge and support your warriors. And so to see that not happen, but I think, you know, Anita, there's a lot of money in making war. There's not a lot of money taking care of the people who come home from war.
Yeah, because the people come home in pieces. They're no longer that strong, you know, warrior that they show on the recruiting commercials. You know, they've been broken down, both spiritually, mentally, and physically. So they're no longer in quote unquote perfect shape. And you know, I'm a veteran myself, so I know for a fact that you know, just the people that are in the local VA hospital here in Tampa, I mean, huge spinal cord ward, just for the spinal cord injuries. It's, and then they become closed off from society, these people that are really, really physically damaged. And the PTSD people, they're not even getting the care. So this has become a huge problem, and our government does not want to fix it. They want to spend tons of money on war, and they want to make sure that, you know, they smash and grab for all the oil and fossil fuels, but they don't want to take care of the results of their actions, which are broken down people. And that is really, really sad.
Well, I think in the book, In Totems of September, because it takes place after 9/11, one of the chapters is about an Iraqi veteran and his view of the war and his participation. And again, another chapter is about two Afghani veterans. And it talks about post-traumatic stress disorder, and it talks about what it does to families and what needs to be done for healing. But I think that it's also important that, you know, we do acknowledge that as rough as post-traumatic stress disorder can be, at least through our teachings, through the Native teachings, that there are ways through it. Many years ago now, it's been 30 years ago now, I had the great honor of being the only woman on the Veterans Administration Native American Vietnam Veterans Working Group, and I had the great honor of working with Tom Holm out of the University of Arizona. He's retired now, just an amazing man. Harold Barth and Frank Montour and Sidney Flame and Steve Silbert, just some amazing men, and I was the only woman on the group, so it was an experience in many ways. But, you know, the book, my book, Totems of September, talks about trauma, and one of my favorite characters in the book is a young man named Jerome Barth, who's the great-grandson of Geronimo, who is a boarding school survivor and also a World War II vet. And he's the first responder, he's a recovery worker at 9/11. And it talks about how his traditions and his culture come into play in terms of why he goes back from the ranch where he's living in Oklahoma to be a first responder. And one of the things, Anita, that's been very eerie for me with the book is writing back in 2006, about the problems of the first responders and our Iraqi veterans and our Afghani veterans and their family, and never even realizing that I was writing about events that were not going to become clear until, you know, several years later. But part of what the book speaks about is how there is healing through our Native traditions, and I don't know if your audience is aware of things such as the Enemy Way in the Navajo culture, which is the whole community comes together for ceremony to heal the
right.
Because as is well known in our Native communities, number one, you always, always, always honor your veterans. They are placed ahead of everyone, you know, and just our honor. And for me, seeing how our veterans are not honored is a real cultural clash for me, because that's just not how it is in my culture. For example, if you're on a dance ground and an eagle feather drops, it's a veteran that is allowed to retrieve that feather, because there are warriors, and so many of our ceremonies are directed at healing warriors and bringing them back into our community. And my father and his my Uncle Jack was a very highly placed Pentagon colonel who was in World War II and Korea and Vietnam, and my cousin John was a two-tour helicopter pilot in Vietnam, so warriors run very strongly in my family. And I can remember in Vietnam my dad just being furious at the Vietnam veterans being treated the way they were when they came back, that it went so against our culture. And in my book, Totems of September, it talks about the healing that Native communities have for our veterans and how they're venerated, which is a very different approach than what we're seeing now. And one of the things I knew that I was very, very struck by and very upset by when the Seahawks won the, what was it, Super Bowl this year, 750,000 people turned out to welcome the Seahawks home from winning the Super Bowl. And we haven't had one parade in this community for our veterans, you know, in terms of anything like that. I you know, when was the last time you heard of 750,000 people turning out to welcome a veteran home? But we welcomed a football team home. And I just had such an issue with that. It's not that I wanted to take away from the happiness of the community, but it was just so offensive to me to know that our veterans don't get that kind of welcome. And for me, and part of writing Tones of September was to honor our veteran people. And I look at people like Tammy Duckworth, you know, Representative Tammy Duckworth, and the incredible courage these people have in moving forward. And so when you say to me, why do we have 22 veterans a day committing suicide, I said, because we don't even acknowledge that they're home or that they're there. And we need to. And I think the Wounded Warrior Project is a great project for doing that.
They become invisible. That's the whole thing. They go into the hospitals, they get their care, they can't get work. You know, if they still have their families together, that's a good thing, but more often than not, their families crumble when they come back, and they become the invisible people just under the surface, and it's just really a sad way to treat the veterans. Even fundraisers and things like that, just for local veterans, you know, it's amazing. It's just amazing that what we could be doing, you know. And it's not done, and there's this what do they call it? The cult of personality. You just made, you know, an example of that by stating, you know, about the sports team. Okay, the sports team becomes the cult of personality. What happens if we took each one of these wounded warriors, which you mentioned them as a project, the Wounded Warrior Project, if we took each one of these wounded warriors and made them the cult of personality, not just, you know, a talking head on television or an entertainment person, but somebody that the community could honor and revere. Not honor for what they did in overseas. Do you know what I'm saying? But
yes.
Honor that they were willing to go and overseas and try to make the United States a better place, even though that didn't happen, because we know now that they went over there to protect corporate interests, not our interests as a nation.
I want to talk a little bit about the whole thing, particularly with the Supreme Court decision that just came out that gives even more.
Oh boy, that's a big one, huh?
Election. Yeah, I was anybody surprised that that was the outcome? No, that was a foregone conclusion. But I think that history certainly repeats itself. And as a Native person looking at the invasions, and I will not call them wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They were invasions. We invaded. You know, it was not a war. We invaded. And I think that the whole, if you look at the whole propaganda behind it, you know, it's a we versus they mentality and those bad Muslims and those bad people and all this stuff. And without American people, and I really get angry about this, our schools are so deficient in terms of teaching world history and understanding different cultures. We are so incredibly parochial. But if you go back and you look at the and I want to talk again about the boarding schools, but if you talk about the governmental attitude towards Native people, which is you're in the way of our resources, you're in the way of our manifest destiny, you're in the way of our timber, which was why the Klamath tribe was terminated in 1954, because the biggest untouched stand upon a rise of pine and the country was on Klamath land, get rid of the Indians and you can have the resources. And another thing people may not know about our treaties, because they still are in effect, although there's huge efforts now to get rid of them, huge efforts, but there was a treaty between the Klamath tribe and the U.S. government to not draw the rivers down to protect the salmon. And in 2001, Dick Cheney, that paragon of whatever you want to call him, he's certainly not one of my favorite people in any way, shape, or form, when it gets the treaties, drew down the Klamath River and had the biggest, massive salmon kill-off ever in history, and it's taken, I don't know if the runs have ever come back, in violation of treaty rights. And I think if you look back at the whole attitude about why the U.S. invades countries, including my nation, the Cowlitz Nation, which is a freestanding nation, it's always about economics. Wars are always economics. You know, they put it in terms of holy wars, you know, it's the Christians against the Muslims, and it was our, you know, our country had been invaded. It's like, no, our country wasn't invaded. We had a terrorist attack by Saudi Arabia. It had nothing to do, Saudi Arabians, excuse me, not Saudi Arabia, but, you know, 14 of the 19 terrorists were Saudi, and it's like, had nothing to do with Iraq. But how do you get people to buy into war? You have the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. You have the Maine. You go back forever. It's the same thing. But it's always about territory. It's always about resources and territory. Every single war is economic. Always. That's the cause of it. It's the start of it, and it's where it goes. I think that what people don't understand, Anita, is that Afghanistan is tribal. Iraq is tribal, and people don't really understand the difference between national and tribal. And
right.
So I think that we had this incredible naivety. I, for one, never thought that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11, even though Dick Cheney kept saying it did. It's like, no, they didn't. And I never believed that there were weapons of mass destruction. I never believed any of that, but you frighten people. And if you see another group as subhuman, as certainly we did in Vietnam, then you can perpetrate all kinds of atrocities on them. And I want to talk about that just for a second in terms of the boarding schools and of Dan Snyder's incredibly racist term, Redskins. Redskins was used to describe the bodies of Native American people after they were killed and their scalps were taken to get a bounty, which was $200. That's what the term Redskins means. It does not honor me. But when you call someone a Redskin, you have reduced them to something subhuman. And therefore, you can perpetrate all kinds of racism against them.
It's kind of like calling an Oriental or a Native American First Nation woman. It's kind of like calling her a squaw. Basically, you're calling her.
It is.
Prostitute. I mean, you know, you're calling her a prostitute. So, is that, you know, to say redskin, it's not just a slang term. It has a meaning behind the word. And,
it has a terrible meaning behind the word.
Right, right, that people are just not aware of. And when they're made aware of it, then it's their responsibility to change it. You know? So I agree with you. I think that the name of that sports team should be changed, the Redskins. They should change it. And they're fully aware.
Aware. But again, I mean, I think that it's this whole thing, well, you know, and if I hear this one more time, I'm going to probably yell, well, you know, Native communities have other more important things. It's like, no, there's nothing more important than racism, because racism is what allowed you guys to put us on reservations. Racism is what allowed L. Brooks Patterson, that virtue of paragon or whatever you want to call him, that I have lots of words for him, to say that they could put all of us Indians back into Detroit, put a fence around us, and throw in blanket and corn. And for those of you who don't know what that reference is, it was smallpox-laden blankets, which they gave to those as Native people, to kill us. And
right.
When you call someone a redskin, then you can say, well, put all the Indians in a fence in Detroit and throw in blankets. And people were more upset over, he said that, you know, he wouldn't go into Detroit for a movie than they were about the fact that they insulted every single Native person in this country by saying, you know, put a fence around it. What is the message to that, as a Native person? But we still get that. But if he had said, we're going to round up all the African-American people in Detroit, put them behind a fence, and throw them blankets, can you imagine the outrage that would have come out of that? you know. And David Barton, he is a quote-unquote Christian historian, has called those terrorists and said that you know, we deserved genocide because we were terrorists against the settlers that were taking our land. And so I think if you look at historically how the U.S. government has always functioned and how people buy into it, there's always an enemy. It's the evil empire. It's the axis of evil. It's the Native people. Now there's this big push that we, and it's in Canada too, that you know, we can't have separate justice for, you know, races, which means that Indians better assimilate again because we're getting all these special privileges. It's like, I'm still waiting for my special privilege. But I think, again, we have to look at historically, and that's why I think Totems of September takes a very different view of 9/11. It's not written from a political viewpoint. It's written from a spiritual viewpoint about healing and what really does happen to people in traumatic situations and how people can get through that and can maintain their humanness. And for me, looking at my own life, it's been my traditions that have allowed me to move forward, even when there are days I just don't want to do it anymore. I live in a very, very rural community, and one of my neighbors was running for county council, and there are water rights and treaty rights that have to do with the Yakima tribe. My family had allotments on, you know, land on the Yakima reservation. I'm not enrolled Yakima. I'm Cowlitz, but my neighbor was ranting on and on and on about the water moratorium this and the dam, you know, Yakima Indians that and the blank, blank Yakima Indians the other thing. And I finally looked at him and I said, you know, Steve, I don't know how to break it to you, but I'm related to people down on the Yakima Res. And there were several of the neighbors out. I live in a very small community. And the conversation came to a dead silence. And you could just see people kind of take this step back. And to deal with that, and you know, every single day is exhausting, every single day. And I think that we as Native people have been silenced so much. It's like, you know, Roger Goodell saying, well, you know, Dan Snyder is making this original American foundation. It's like, oh, my Lord, so we're going to buy us off with a few beads. We're going to buy Manhattan with a few beads again. And that's how I see this. It's like him trotting out our very beloved code talkers, you know, and saying, we'll put some Redskins back on it, and that will make it okay. It's like he knows it's not okay. And if anyone used a Jewish racial slur and said, well, let's call the team the Blank Skins, there would be all kinds of people, and people would be offended about that. Because it's Native, it's for the taking. And I want to talk about just a couple more things in terms, if I can, a minute about misappropriation of Native spirituality, because the whole book, Totems, is about Native spirituality. I want to talk about James Arthur Ray for a moment and about people buying into what they see as Native culture. And it's kind of just a caveat, a buyer beware. For those of you who don't remember about James Arthur Ray, he was the man that built that sweat box. I will not dignify it with the term sweat lodge. It was not in the desert and killed three people and wounded, I don't injured, I don't know how many other.
I remember this case.
Yes,
yeah.
He served, I think, a year and a half for killing three people. But I think we have such a mythology about Native people and our history. And what I see is that people have this fantasy about what Native traditions are, and they want to be part of it, and they think that they can buy it. Well, anybody who agrees to pay $10,000 to be starved, put out in the desert, then given a huge meal and marched into a box with 62 other people with no water, no air, and no heat, and pay $10,000 for it, you have to wonder what their need is in terms of why would you even consider that something legitimate? It's beyond me. And I would say to people, if people tell you, number one, they're a shaman, run the other way. If people tell you they're a shaman and they want to charge you for their services, keep running even faster. Because we don't sell our medicine. We don't advertise who we are. If someone wants to put, like, Christina Fallon, the daughter of the governor of Oklahoma, with her very, very, very alabaster skin and her red lips and her fake red headdress, if she thinks she's honoring me as a Native, what I'm saying is, no, you're dishonoring me because you don't know my tradition. And I think that's the most important thing. And, you know, I want to talk about drawing all this together, whether it be veterans or first responders or people from the boarding school. All of those things have happened to us as Native people. And what has allowed us to go forward is our traditions and our cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me, is where the book starts and where the book ends. It's about you know, the grace that we're given by our Creator and our traditions and our understanding our place in the world. And one of the things that I want to say that's very positive is people, Native people, are reclaiming their languages, and we're trying as hard as we can to reclaim our traditions. And when it's been completely obliterated, it's very hard to reclaim something that's almost non-existent. But we're trying. And I really want to say to people, don't tell me the name Redskin honors me. It doesn't. When you dress up on Halloween with feathers in your hair and you paint your face red, you're not honoring me. When you go to Cleveland Indians with that horrible mascot and you paint your face up and you beat on your chest, are you do like some guy did with Bill Murray from ESPN? None of that honors me. It makes me less than human, much less than human. And I think that we really need to talk about humanness, and that ultimately is what the book is about, is humanness. I'm looking for something I want to read to you because most people do not know about how Thomas Jefferson addressed Native people in the Declaration of Independence. Are you aware of that, Anita, how he addressed this?
No.
Basically, he said that we're savages. We're terrible savages that should basically be exterminated. And that is, I'm looking for the exact language here in the
Declaration of Independence. I was not aware that he said that. You learn something every day, but, you know,
yeah,
I definitely want
to
hear
the exact words, but it's basically that one of their indictments against the king was that he, here it is right here. This is the exact quote from the Declaration of Independence. He has excited domestic insurgents amongst us and has endeavored to bring the inhabitants of our frontier, those merciless Indian savages, who know in rules of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of acts, sexes, and concerns. I believe is the last word here. So that's what we've been known as since the Declaration of Independence, as merciless Indian savages. So when we talk about, people are not aware of that. So when people talk about our founding fathers, it's like, maybe, you know, not so much mine. I'm sorry, I can read the whole thing again. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. And that is how we're addressed as Native people in the Declaration of Independence.
Wow. That is amazing. That is amazing that he said that. I mean, I would never ever have thought that I would hear that kind of quote. But this was before Manifest Destiny. I mean, they were putting all of those thoughts together, how they were going to, you know, our founding fathers, with how they were going to push westward and just, you know, smash and grab for the land and the natural resources. And, you know, there isn't much that's changed from that time to now. And you know, it hadn't happened. They were planning it, and that shows what the mindset was of our leaders, of our forefathers. They weren't such nice people.
I don't think anything changed, Anita. Well, your heroes are not my heroes, as we say in Indian country. And I would say to you, if you looked at the propaganda that Cheney and Bush put out for invading Iraq, you tell me how it's any different than what I just read to you.
Yeah, it's not any different. It's not any different at all. It's the same. And you had mentioned earlier about, you know, everything about war being, you know, for corporate and natural resources. All anybody has to do is go and take a look at General Smedley Butler's piece of writing, War is a Racket. And you can find that online in its entirety, and you can read the whole thing. And he got it, he understood it, and was trying to tell people that were coming after him exactly what war was about. And, you know, nothing, and the propaganda, of course, is what we as a people have experienced because they want public opinion of the war to be favorable. So, you know, we have things that have occurred that we could say are false flags, and propaganda, which has been foisted on us by our mainstream media. So,
well, I do hold the mainstream media very culpable in the run-up to Iraq. And
oh, yeah.
It was, and the whole loss of writ of habeas corpus, which people don't even understand, when Bush took habeas corpus, where people even understand what that means. And the whole issue of, you know, what it's like to be someone such as myself who's told that I can't get on an airplane because I don't have, quote-unquote, a valid ID. I don't think people understand the implications of what it's like to be on the receiving end of that and what losing those liberties really, truly means. And I think people just don't want to hear it. I think they really don't want to hear it. And in you ask, you know, what was the process of writing the book? And I don't know that the process needed me has been so much as, I mean, it was a very remarkable process. I think for me the more important thing was coming towards the end of the book and having such implications for my life and other people and Native people and people who traumatized that in this whole country that what we didn't do and come together and stay together very long was out of the spiritual need we had for healing, that we went very quickly
right.
from the spiritual need of healing into war. And I want to talk about something that's very close to me right now. I live about 100 miles away from where that terrible landslide was here in the state of Washington, up in Oso.
Right,
and,
right. Far, yeah.
I mean, it's just been horrible. But one of the things that has come out of this that I hope remains is the incredible sense of community, and not are we against them, and not that someone else is bad or someone's not, but it affected Native communities, non-Native communities, you know, people of all, you know, backgrounds. But what has happened is this incredible courage in people holding together. And it affected some very good friends of mine very, very directly. And my thoughts and prayers are with all those families tonight. But I think what was very sad to me out of 9/11 and those towers coming down was, in some ways, people say it was a loss of innocence to this country. It's like, not for those of us who are Native people. There was no loss of innocence. That's not news to us. We've had millions of our people, you know, terminated deliberately, very deliberately. But I think it was such a shock to our country at large that we could be so vulnerable. And I hope that people will read the book, but I hope they'll read it with an idea of looking at their own spirituality and how spirituality can really bring us together and heal trauma, which I don't think our country has recovered from 9/11 yet. I think that we're going to be forever changed by what happened, and I'm sad to say I think we didn't get changed in very many good ways. I think it changed us for the worse instead of taking that incredible sense of community and love that people have for each other and building on that and moving this country forward in a very positive way. I think just the opposite happened, and that's very sad to me. But ultimately, the book, and I have to thank my characters who came and talked to me, is a book of hope. It's really about redemption. And I realize we're almost, it must be close to midnight your time there.
Yeah, we're getting close to the end. And did you have any closing comments about how do we heal now? Where do we go from here?
Well, I think that as a psychologist and a therapist for 40 years, ultimately what I saw in terms of people who really were able to move forward was spiritual healing. And as a Western-trained psychologist, I was taught to never talk about that. And I threw that
mm-hmm.
out, that idea out a long time ago. But really, it's healing of the spirit. And the first way that people begin to heal their spirits is to be allowed to talk about what was taken away from them.
Right.
And to talk about what it's like to lose what we as Native people have lost and what other trauma survivors have lost and what survivors of sexual abuse have lost and what our veterans have lost, to be able to talk about the loss, not in a way of poor me, per se, but as our reality, that this is what happened, this is my truth, and this is what
mm-hmm.
I've experienced. Because in the trauma, there's such a commonality. You know, and it's why we can give it a diagnosis now, because there's such a commonality. But to be able to say, this was my truth, this is what happened. And to have people take that as the truth and then to start looking at the spiritual connections that we all have as people, because ultimately we're all more human than otherwise. And I hope that if people do read the book, that what they see in themselves is their own capacity to heal through healing their spirit. I don't care if that's the Christian religion or the Muslim religion or the Buddhist, it's finding your spirit and connecting at that spiritual level. And people talk about that in New Age, and I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about what traditions do you have from your mother's family, from your father's family. You know, my mother was Greek. There's tremendous traditions on the Greek side of my family and on the Native side. But it's finding, you know, what inside of you defines your humanness as something positive, and because that's spirit. And it's not like the James Arthur Ray where we pay $10,000 to go be killed. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about the innate spark in all of us that gets us through the hard times and connecting those sparks. In chapter 5, well, I think it's chapter 5 in it, I'm not sure, but in a chapter called The Flying Salmon, it's these three women who go down for a lodge, and at the end of the lodge, what they see are these incredibly beautiful blue and turquoise lights inside the sweat lodge. And I don't go into detail about that because that's very private to me, but those lights turn into the spirits of 9/11 and are gathered together in healing as they make their journey up through to heaven, through back to their time of the Creator. So for me, healing is about finding spirit and holding through that. And I just want to say, Anita, I know of what I speak. I've had 2 cardiac arrests, and I had my 6th heart surgery a little over a year ago. And I can absolutely say to you that what has gotten me through is spirituality and my connection with my Native people and my traditions. And if you look at what pulls people through hurricanes and tornadoes and landslides, it's gathering together with people, you know, with spirit. And that's what I would say that the whole book is about. It's about gathering of that spirit. And, in fact, actually, Khalid's name, Kalitsky, the word means gathering medicine spirit. And I think I want to leave you on one last thought. I sent you a little blurb of a book I'm getting ready to write, and it's called Saving Sanity. And it's about how when really horrible things have happened, I was taught to make traditional Native medicine called smudge. And so when I have a really bad time or a bad day, I sit down and I gather my herbs around me, and my containers, and I put in herbs together, and I smell them, and I think about the earth that comes from, and I put them together knowing that they're going to be passed from my hands to someone else, hopefully that we share spirit and healing. And that, for me, is how I save my sanity, is I connect my spirit with other people around me in a good way, I hope. And I hope we did tonight with your audience. And Anita, thank you for your time.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. This was just amazing and enlightening. And I really, you know, we covered quite a lot of topics. And I think that this is something that people need to be awake to. You know, we're going through some really traumatic times on the globe, and how do we come back from that and center and ground and heal? And that book that you wrote, Totems of September, that is going to be a lot of information that people, and it might be too heavy for some people, but I would say after looking at it, it's. I know as I go through the book in bits and pieces, and I've only seen bits and pieces at this point, I want to sit down and read the whole thing from front to back. I know I'm going to be learning about my own personal healing, so I'm looking forward to that. But I want to thank you so much for being on the show. And I just remember that the link to the show is an archive, and it lasts forever. So you can pass that around, and people can listen to the archive. If they've come on in the middle and they've only heard a part of the show, they can go back tomorrow and listen to the beginning. Just by hitting the same link, it'll take you right to the archive. And we will be back next Friday at 10 p.m. with another special guest. Robin, I want to thank you so much for giving us 2 hours of your time and really enlightening us. And we hope to have you back. in the future.
So, well, I hope
would love to have
I'd like to say one thing in parting. In my language, we say mossy mossy, and we end with a term called, which was basically all my relations, which is my thanks and acknowledgement of everyone who's ever been, who's with us now, and who will ever be. And when we end any ceremony, we always say all my relations. And so I would like to say mossy mossy, which is thank you in my language, and also say all my relations, which is thanking everyone who joined us tonight, and particularly you, Anita. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
All right, well, good night, and I'm going to close with a song by Tedeschi Trucks Band, Made Up Mind, and see you all on the radio next week. Thank you so much. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.